This Love is Fannie Brewster. Good afternoon. This is Fannie Brewster speaking with you today from Jung's own words. And today I'm going to be doing a reading from the Spirit in Man, Art, and Literature. It's a section, actually a subsection in Psychology and Literature entitled The Artist. And so we begin. The secret of creativeness, like that of the freedom of the will, is a transcendental problem which the psychologist cannot answer, but can only describe. The creative personality, too, is a riddle we may try to answer in various ways, but always in vain. Nevertheless, modern psychologists have not been deterred from investigating the problem of the artist and his art. Freud thought he had found a key to the work of art by deriving it from the personal experience of the artist. This was a possible approach, for it was conceivable that a work of art might, like a neurosis, be traced back to complexes. It was Freud's great discovery that neuroses have a quite different, and that they originate in real or imagined emotional experiences in early childhood. Some of his followers, in particular Rank and Speckle, adopted a similar approach and arrived at similar results. It is undeniable that the artist's personal psychology may occasionally be traced out in the roots and in the furthest ramifications of his work. This view, that personal factors in many ways determine the artist's choice of material and the form he gives it, is not in itself new. Credit, however, is certainly due to the Freudian school for showing how far-reaching this influence is and the curious analogies to which it gives rise. Freud considers a neurosis to be a substitute for a direct means of gratification. For him, it is something inauthentic, a mistake, a subterfuge, an excuse, a refusal to face facts. In short, something essentially negative that should never have been. One hardly dares to put in a good word for a neurosis, since it is apparently nothing but a meaningless and therefore irritating disturbance. By treating a work of art as something that can be analyzed in terms of the artist's repressions, we bring it into questionable proximity with a neurosis where, in a sense, it finds itself in good company, for the Freudian method treats religion and philosophy in the same way. No legitimate objection can be raised to this if it is admitted to be no more than an unearthing of those personal determinants without which a work of art is unthinkable. But if it is claimed that such an analysis explains the work of art itself, then a categorical denial is called for. The essence of a work of art is not to be found in the personal idiosyncrasies that creep into it. Indeed, the more there are of them, the less it is a work of art, but rather in its rising above the personal and speaking from the mind and heart of the artist to the mind and heart of mankind. The personal aspect of art is a limitation and even a vice. Art that is only personal, or predominantly so, truly deserves to be treated as a neurosis. When the Freudian school advances the opinion that all artists are underdeveloped and undeveloped personalities with marked infantile autoerotic, that may be true of the artist as a man, but it is not applicable to the man as an artist. In this capacity, he is neither autoerotic nor heteroerotic, nor erotic in any sense. He is in the highest degree objective, impersonal, and even inhuman or superhuman. For as an artist, he is nothing but his work and not a human being. Every creative person is a duality or a synthesis of contradictory qualities. On the one side, he is a human being with a personal life, while on the other, he is an impersonal creative process. As a human being, he may be sound or morbid, and his personal psychology can and should be explained in personal terms. But he can be understood as an artist only in terms of his creative achievement. We should make a great mistake if we reduced the mode of life of an English gentleman or a Prussian officer or a cardinal to personal factors. The gentleman, the officer, and the high ecclesiastic function as impersonal officials, and each role has its own objective psychology. Although the artist is the exact opposite of an official, there is nevertheless a secret analogy between them insofar as the specifically artistic psychology is more collective than personal in character. Art is a kind of innate drive that seizes the human being and makes him its instrument. The artist is not a person endowed with free will who seeks his own ends, but one who allows art to realize its purposes through him. As a human being, he may have moods and a will and personal aims, but as an artist, he is a man in a higher sense. He is a collective man, a vehicle, and a molder of the unconscious psychic life of mankind. That is his office, and it is sometimes so heavy a burden that he is fated to sacrifice happiness and everything that makes life worth living for the ordinary human being. As K.G. Kara says, and I quote, "Strange are the ways by which genius is announced, for what distinguishes so supremely endowed a being is that, for all the freedom of his life and the clarity of his thought, he is everywhere hemmed round and prevailed upon by the unconscious, the mysterious God within him, so that ideas flow to him, he knows not whence. He is driven to work and to create. He knows not to what end, and is mastered by an impulse for constant growth and development. He knows not whither." End quote. In these circumstances, it is not at all surprising that the artist is an especially interesting specimen for the critical analysis of the psychologist. His life cannot be otherwise than full of conflicts, for two forces are at war within him. On the one hand, the justified longing of the ordinary man for happiness, satisfaction, and security, and on the other, a ruthless passion for creation, which may go so far as to override every personal desire. If the lives of artists are, as a rule, so exceedingly unsatisfactory, not to say tragic, it is not because of some sinister dispensation of fate, but because of some inferiority in their personality or an inability to adapt. A person must pay dearly for the divine gift of creative fire. It is as though each of us was born with a limited store of energy. In the artist, the strongest force in his makeup, that is, his creativeness, will seize and all but monopolize this energy, leaving so little over that nothing of value can come of it. The creative impulse can drain him of his humanity to such a degree that the personal ego can exist only on an inferior level and is driven to develop all sorts of defects, ruthlessness, selfishness, vanity, and other infantile traits. These inferiorities are the only means by which it can maintain its vitality and prevent itself from being wholly depleted. The autoeroticism or the selfishness of certain artists is like that of illegitimate or neglected children who from their earliest years develop bad qualities to protect themselves from the destructive influence of a loveless environment. Such children easily become ruthless and selfish and later display an invisible egoism by remaining all their lives infantile and helpless or by actively offending against morality and the law. How can we doubt that it is his art that explains the artist and not the insufficiencies and conflicts of his personal life. These are nothing but the regrettable results of his being an artist, a man upon whom a heavier burden is laid than upon ordinary mortals. A special ability demands a greater expenditure of energy, which must necessarily leave a deficit on some other side of life. It makes no difference whether the artist knows that his work is generated, grows, and matures within him, or whether he imagines that it is his own invention. In reality, it grows out of him as a child its mother. The creative process has a feminine quality, and the creative work arises from unconscious depths. We might truly say, from the realm of the mothers. Whenever the creative force dominates or predominates, life is ruled and shaped by the unconscious rather than by the conscious will, and the ego is swept along on an underground current, becoming nothing more than a helpless observer of events. Forms the poet's fate and determines his psychology. It is not Goethe that creates Faust, but Faust that creates Goethe. And what is Faust? Faust is essentially a symbol. By this, I do not mean that it is an allegory pointing to something all too familiar, but the expression of something profoundly alive in the soul of every German, which Goethe helped to bring to birth. Could we conceive of anyone but a German writing Faust, or thus spake Zarathustra? Both of them strike a chord that vibrates in the German psyche, evoking a primordial image, as Burckhardt once called it, the figure of a healer or teacher of mankind, or of a wizard. It is the archetype of the wise old man, the helper and redeemer, but also of the magician, deceiver, corrupter, and tempter. This image has lain buried and dormant in the unconscious since the dawn of history. It is awakened whenever the times are out of joint and a great error deflects society from the right path. For when people go astray, they feel the need of a guide or teacher, and even of a physician. The seductive error is like a poison that can also act as a cure, and the shadow of a savior can turn into a fiendish destroyer. These opposing forces are at work in the mythical healer himself. The physician who heals wounds is himself the bearer of a wound, a classic example being Chiron. In Christianity, it is the wound in the side of Christ, the great physician. Faust, characteristically enough, is unwounded, which means that he is untouched by the moral problem. A man can be as high-minded as Faust and as devilish as Mephistopheles if he is able to split his personality into two halves, and only then is he capable of feeling 6,000 feet beyond good and evil. Mephistopheles was cheated of his reward, Faust's soul, and for this he presented a bloody reckoning 100 years later. But who now seriously believes that poets utter truths that apply to all men? And if they do, in what way would we have to regard the work of art? In itself, an archetype is neither good nor evil. It is morally neutral, like the gods of antiquity, and becomes good or evil only by content with the conscious mind, or else a paradoxical mixture of both. Whether it will be conducive to good or evil is determined knowingly or unknowingly by the conscious attitude. There are many such archetypal images, but they do not appear in the dreams of individuals or in works of art, unless they are activated by a deviation from the middle way. Whenever conscious life becomes one-sided or adopts a false attitude, these images instinctively rise to the surface in dreams and in the visions of artists and seers to restore the psychic balance, whether the individual metaphor of the epoch. In this way, the work of the artist meets the psychic needs of the society in which he lives, and therefore means more than his personal fate, aware of it or not. Being essentially the instrument of his work, he is subordinate to it, and we have no right to expect him to interpret it for us. He has done his utmost by giving it form, and must leave the interpretation to others and to the future. A great work of art is like a dream. For all its apparent obviousness, it does not explain itself and is always ambiguous. A dream never says, "You ought," or "This is the truth." It presents an image in much the same way as nature allows a plant to grow, and it is up to us to draw conclusions. If a person has a nightmare, it means he is either too much given to fear or too exempt from it. If he dreams of a wise old man, it means he is either too much of a pedant or else in need of a teacher. In a subtle way, both meanings come to the same thing, as we realize when we let a work of art act upon us, upon the artist. To grasp its meaning, we must allow it to shape us as it shaped him. Then we also understand the nature of his primordial experience. He has plunged into the healing and redeeming depths of the collective psyche, where man is not lost in the isolation of consciousness and its errors and sufferings, but where all men are caught in a common rhythm which allows the individual to communicate his feelings and strivings to mankind as a whole. This reimmersion in the state of participation mystique is the secret of artistic creation and of the effect which great art has upon us. For at that level of experience, it is no longer the weal or woe of the individual that counts, but the life of the collective. That is why every great work of art is objective and impersonal and yet profoundly moving. And that is also why the personal life of the artist is at most a help or a hindrance, but is never essential to his creative task. He may go the way of the Philistine, a good citizen, a fool, or a criminal. His personal career may be interesting, inevitable, but it does not explain his art. So today, that is the completion of the reading of Jung speaking about the artist in the spirit in man, art, and literature. Thank you for listening today and joining. And we will be seeing you, listening, hearing, and being in touch with each other soon. Thank you.